This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Stealth War, How China Took Over While America's Elite Slept, by Brigadier General Robert Spalding, U.S. Air Force retired, with Seth Kaufman. Read for you by Ray Porter. To all who have pledged their life, liberty, and sacred honor to preserve our republic. Preface. Knowledge in the West is built on a foundation of documented facts. The historical record has been filled with the accounts and chronicles of nations built on a foundation of law. In the United States, the Freedom of Information Act ensures the disclosure, at some point, of information controlled by the U.S. government. But how do you document the history and governance of a nation that does not subscribe to the conventions of the West? What if such a nation is not eager to see their secrets revealed? What if they are not subject to government disclosure rules? For too long, I've borne the burden of stories about the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, and the awareness that their system ensures that secrets stay buried. This book is my attempt to enter those stories into the record. My hope is that by doing so, others will be willing to come forward on the record also, as the risks to their lives and fortunes will be mitigated by our slow disengagement from the CCP. Of course, there is another possibility. If we do not disengage, then we will become ever more constrained in our speech and freedoms as the CCP seeks to suppress the knowledge of our own history. If this comes to pass, this book, and indeed the Constitution, will have little relevance. Because I wanted to make this book as user-friendly as possible, and because I conducted hundreds of interviews, many of which required confidentiality, I have opted to dispense with endnotes. This book represents only a fraction of what I've learned, but it was written to address an urgent need. To bring the stealth war into public view. It was never intended to be an encyclopedia. I leave it to future patriots to delve deeper and document the mysteries of the CCP, to provide a basis of knowledge, and to aid the continuation of our republic and the freedom it guarantees. Introduction. I know something about stealth. In 1998, I began training to pilot B-2 Spirits, known far and wide as stealth bombers. The B-2 was, at that time, the high-profile new weapon in the U.S. Air Force arsenal, a dazzling billion-dollar high-tech machine that looked like it had flown in from a future century. Its continuous curvature allowed it to avoid detection by the electromagnetic waves used by radar systems to track objects. In other words, I learned to fly a plane that achieved something every military strategist has dreamed of, being invisible. 20 years later, having served as chief China strategist for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and as senior U.S. defense official and defense attaché to the People's Republic of China, I left my position as Senior Director for Strategic Planning at the White House, deeply concerned about a different stealth weapon being turned against my country. For the past 40 years, the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, has been playing a beautiful game. It is sophisticated, yet simple. It is a competition to gain control and influence across the planet, and to achieve that outcome without resorting to military engagement. Flying quietly below the radar, the CCP has been acquiring technology without paying a cent toward developing it, carefully taking control of the world's shipping businesses, infiltrating our corporations and science laboratories, and using American investor dollars to float the cost of its own factories and companies, and then, adding insult to injury, insisting that that money stay in China. War between nation states in the 21st century looks much different than war in the 19th and 20th centuries. Instead of bombs and bullets, it's about ones and zeros and dollars and cents. Economics, finance, data information, manufacturing, infrastructure, and communications. Control those fronts today, and you can win a war without firing a shot. It's a simple, logical strategy, and it is one leaders in the West have been very slow to grasp. Our political, military, corporate, and fiscal leaders have failed to recognize the subtle game the CCP has been playing. They have been operating, understandably, under the now outdated idea that war is fought only with bombs and bullets. The CCP strategy, however, is to fight in other ways, utilizing a variety of tactics. It advocates and sponsors a constant focus on theft, coercion, economic sabotage, and monopolization of infrastructure on a global level, all to increase China's sphere of influence. Everywhere. Like the B-2 bombers I flew, the CCP's stealth war isn't truly covert. It has been hiding in plain sight. How did we miss it? I'm not interested in pointing fingers at one particular party. Both Republican and Democratic elites have missed the signs, or are complicit, and as a patriot who cares about my fellow citizens, my main interest is to defend the people of this country and the ideas that have driven it since it was founded. Perhaps nothing threatens the CCP more than the Constitution of the United States. China's president, Xi Jinping, has stated as much, and CCP documents that I will share make clear that fundamental American concepts, the rights of free speech and freedom of religion, are threats to the authoritarian power of the CCP, which believes that these liberties must never be allowed to take root in China and must never be the rights of Chinese citizens. The CCP's fundamental loathing of our Bill of Rights and other legal protections should be chilling to anyone who values freedom. It is the primary reason I am writing this book. I want to alert the world to China's stealth war and its strategy to dominate the planet by focusing on six spheres of influence: the economy, the military, global diplomacy, technology, education, and infrastructure. China is closing in on achieving its goal of influencing the politicians and corporations of the United States. If this happens, fundamental freedoms we take for granted, the ability to criticize a politician or a policy, to publish political statements, to report on governmental abuse or inefficiency, to sing the lyrics you want, to study literally any subject under the sun, to visit any website, no matter what ideology is espoused, will come under assault. As for our economy, it will continue to erode as the CCP arranges to use our own capital against our own best interests. Trade terms will be less favorable. Chinese-owned and manufactured products will flood our markets, creating a further trade imbalance that will favor the CCP's interests. The job market and average wages will continue to stagnate. Our best and brightest will be recruited by Chinese-owned companies, which are, as we'll see, ultimately property of the CCP. American politicians who attempt to counter pro-CCP rivals will find themselves fighting against operatives who are bought and paid for, as the CCP uses its limitless cash to influence policies in Washington, D.C. Equally frightening, if not more so, the CCP is also using its authoritarian power to reshape, rewrite, and airbrush historical truths, earning the nation a joke moniker among academics who study the disturbing manipulation of historical fact, the People's Republic of Amnesia. The era of digitization makes editing, history, and creating national amnesia a matter of just cutting, pasting, and deleting. A fascinating study by Glenn Tiffert, Peering Down the Memory Hole, documents how past issues of China's leading law journals were published on Chinese digital platforms for academic research, but without specific articles within them that revealed attacks on the concept of rule of law. Those attacks presented an inconvenient truth now that China seeks to portray itself as law-abiding and just. So they were banished. Simply put, writes Tiffert, the Chinese government is leveraging technology to quietly export its domestic censorship regime abroad and, by manipulating how observers everywhere comprehend its past, present, and future, it is enlisting them without their consent in an alarming project to sanitize the historical record and globalize its own competing narratives. The end result, if China succeeds in all its goals, will be a United States of America that is devoid of the principles that shaped our nation. These are the dystopian outcomes that loom before us. It is not a question of if. It is a question of when. Unless we take preventative measures. The strategies the CCP deploys across the globe have been in effect for decades, and under its current power-hungry leader, Xi Jinping, it is trying to accelerate influencing operations by attempting to become the world's technology leader, corner the telecommunications market, and export totalitarian social controls to the leaders in developing nations. This book does not aim to just sound an alarm. It is meant as a call to arms, one that details how the United States and the rest of the free world can combat and break up China's stealth war. In doing so, I hope we can save the very thing that has driven our nation and the world forward for nearly 250 years. A shared value of what Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Winston Churchill termed the four essential liberties in the Atlantic Charter. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. So consider this book a primer on how the CCP has conducted its war, a point-by-point how-to manual for stopping its march toward control of the West, and yes, a terrifying warning. If we fail to respond immediately and decisively to protect our economy, our security, our institutions, and our free society, we will descend, as much of China already has, into a nightmarish dystopian society. A foreign totalitarian state will monitor our lives, our thoughts, who we see, and what we say. And if it doesn't like what we do, or think, or say, it will take action against us. Some cynics will accuse me of being alarmist or sensationalist. These people are afflicted with the same blind spot I once had. I have examined why I was so oblivious to CCP aggression and why the rest of the world still has a similar blind spot. I now attribute it, in part, to hubris, our cocksure confidence in ourselves and our system, our belief that America's socioeconomic model, its war machine, and its political model are the best in the world, has helped fuel a profound confidence that we can overcome any challenge. That confidence has proven short-sighted. The blind spot remains in place and has increased in size because the CCP are professional liars who have had exquisite training. Blinded by our own greed and the dream of globalization, we've been convinced that free trade automatically unlocks the shackles of authoritarianism and paves the way to democracy. The promise of cheap labor, inexpensive goods, and soaring stock prices has been spellbinding. But by giving up our manufacturing expertise and dominance, we have given up our independence and sold out our own citizens by stripping them of work. And we've been duped. Investing in an authoritarian nation that insists the money never leave the country is basically allowing our pockets to be picked, or rather, allowing our treasury to be raided. America, other Western nations, and all democratic countries now face our biggest challenge since World War II, one with dire implications for the United States and the world at large. I hope this book and the much-needed response I pray it spurs is not too late to stop the authoritarian juggernaut, the stealth war that is being waged against us. Chapter 1. Unrestricted Warfare. Over the course of about 12 months between 2016 and 2017, I wooed a major Washington, D.C. think tank. My goal was to get the organization to conduct a study on the Chinese Communist Party's influence in the corporate sector of the United States. I wanted a respected, nonpartisan institution to shine a light on the CCP's operations. How did Chinese diplomats, investors, and businessmen seek to manipulate our captains of industry? Were they building alliances with board members? What business segments did they value the most? Just how inextricably entrenched had they become in American business? And most important, had they succeeded in making U.S. companies act in ways that ultimately served China's interests, not ours? My courtship was calculated. The think tank had been rated among the top five in the United States. It was respected and revered for strategic policy work in politics, international trade, and national security. I had several meetings to discuss the project and was convinced everything was on track. We discussed how important this study would be, how it would turn the corporate and investment world on its head, how it might possibly lead to much-needed policy and national security reforms. In the ultimate declaration of intent when it comes to cash-conscious think tanks, I even arranged for donors to pay for the study. Conducting the study wouldn't cost the organization a dime. My campaign gained traction. I had a compelling idea for a study of national importance. I had found the money to pay for it, and so, one Friday, I received word that the head of the institute agreed to greenlight the study. I was elated. 3 days later, on Sunday evening, the think tank president, a quintessential Beltway insider who had vaulted from governmental appointments to his current position of power and influence, called the donors for the project. "I'm not sure the study is the right fit for us," he told them. He was pulling the plug. He didn't give any other explanation, but once I looked at the board of trustees for his organization, I knew the reason behind the decision. His benefactors were a who's who of China-loving Washington and Wall Street elites, including at least one world-famous figure and a slew of investment house billionaires. The study wasn't the right fit because the people who raised money for the think tank were profiting off of China. They are the same people who refuse to confront China despite the onslaught of horror stories coming from within its borders and hard-to-miss headlines about organ harvesting from prisoners, herding 2 million members of the Muslim Uyghur population into concentration camps, and unilaterally pushing to deprive millions of citizens of Hong Kong of their civil rights. This think tank incident was not an isolated case. When I got to the White House in 2017 as a member of the National Security Council, NSC, I made it a personal mission to meet with many leading think tanks, non-governmental organizations, and law, auditing, and public relations firms that dealt with China. I was eager to seek their help in exposing the Beijing government's influencing operations and sanctioning of illegal behavior. Additionally, I hoped they would help me explore policy options to counter China's economic malfeasance. Time after time, I was rebuffed. People at these organizations would talk with me, and many of them even said they agreed with my concerns, but they claimed they couldn't help. Doing so, some of the more forthright people said, might anger their Chinese funders or business accounts. the list of organizations that refused to engage with me publicly in my official capacity was stunning. Top white shoe New York law firms, organizations with mandates to promote democracy, freedom, and human rights, would refuse to support my mission. The irony of this wasn't lost on me. I was determined to educate America about how China uses money to influence governments and institutions around the world to shape political and economic outcomes to their advantage. But because those same institutions were already under the influence of that money, they were terrified of losing donations or business income if they helped me expose the CCP's strategy. They were, in essence, being manipulated by a foreign power that is America's greatest enemy. I originally suspected that the CCP's conspiracy to infiltrate the United States was actually an alliance between American elites and the CCP. Many of our political leaders regard China as a partner, despite the fact that the CCP has declared itself at war with the West. American power brokers just don't realize what getting rich off Chinese investments in the short term means for us in the long term. Our intricate relations with China should alarm and frighten patriots of all political persuasions. This alliance is nonpartisan. Major figures on the right and on the left have fallen for the short-term gains of involvement with China. One surprising player is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a known opponent of Trump's protectionist instincts, whose family has strong ties to the most powerful people in China. In 1993, McConnell married Elaine Chao, George W. Bush's labor secretary and current Secretary of Transportation. Her father, James Chao, a scion of a powerful shipping family, attended Shanghai Jiaotong University with Jiang Zemin, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, from 1989 to 2002. James Chao moved his family to Taiwan and then to the United States, where in 1964 he founded the Foremost Group, a shipping, trading, and finance firm. He and his old schoolmate Zheng stayed in contact. When Zheng became mayor of Shanghai, Chao reportedly placed an order for two ships to be built at the state-owned shipyard there. According to the May 16, 2001 issue of the South China Morning Post, the two men would meet regularly, and Mr. Chao's business ties to Beijing would deepen as he started chartering his ships to mainland giants, such as COSCO and Sinotrans. This connection is highly disturbing. Elaine Chao's family members, including her father James and her sister Angela, now the CEO of Foremost, have donated at least $1 million to McConnell's campaigns over the years, the New York Times reported in a June 2, 2019 article that explored how the Chao family has benefited from business with China. And according to McConnell's 2008 Senate Financial Disclosure Report, he and his wife received a gift of between $5 million and $25 million. A McConnell spokesman told the press the windfall was an inheritance from Chao's late mother. As Kathleen Clark, a law professor and anti-corruption expert at Washington University in St. Louis, told the New York Times, "This is a family with financial ties to a government that is a strategic rival. It raises a question about whether those familial and financial ties affect Chao when she exercises judgment or gives advice on foreign and national security policy matters that involve China." Meanwhile, McConnell has evidently developed close personal ties as well. The 2001 South China Morning Post report reads, "Ms. Chao and Mr. McConnell married in February 1993, and in December the pair met Mr. Zheng in Beijing, joined by Ms. Chao's father. Mitch McConnell's father-in-law is a man who has made untold millions. It seems likely he made those millions in part through his relationship with the General Secretary of China. Meanwhile, in 2016, just days after Trump was elected president, the board of directors at the Bank of China announced that McConnell's sister-in-law, Angela Chow, had been appointed a non-executive director of the bank. This marked her second major appointment in China, having previously served, along with her dad, on the board of CSSC Holdings, according to author Peter Schweizer's book, Secret Empires. CSSC, by the way, stands for China State Shipbuilding Corporation, the largest defense contractor in China. It's alarming to think that our Senate leader's sister-in-law meets with the corporate leaders of America's number one business adversary and sits on the board of its national bank. This should be a major concern to anyone who believes in good governance, but it's precisely the kind of access the CCP dreams of for its influencing operations. Did anyone in G.W. Bush's administration wonder about the fact that its Secretary of Labor, Elaine Chao, who served in a time when millions of jobs began vanishing from U.S. soil, just happened to be a family friend of the President of China? What's worse, the daughter of a man who made millions shipping goods from China while befriending the President of China is now overseeing U.S. transportation. This is distressing, considering that China now seeks to control the world's shipping and aviation industries. Her own family ties to China, financial, historical, and emotional, leave her and her husband open to possible manipulation. Democrats are just as tainted. According to Secret Empires, Hunter Biden, the son of former Vice President Joe Biden, teamed up with the Bank of China to create a $1 billion investment fund called Bohai Harvest, RST. Schweizer reveals that in early December 2013, Hunter Biden flew with his father on Air Force Two to China. While the vice president was meeting with CCP leaders, Hunter may have had some meetings of his own, approximately 10 days after the trip to Beijing, the deal for $1 billion in funds, backed by the Chinese government, was finalized. A July 7, 2019 New Yorker article reported that the deal had been signed before the trip, and a business license came through shortly afterward. Everything about the deal, the players involved, the timing, the amount of cash, reeks of undue influence on the part of both China and the profiteering son of a premier power broker. As Schweizer wrote in a May 11, 2019 op-ed piece for the New York Post, it was an unprecedented arrangement, the government of one of America's fiercest competitors going into business with the son of one of America's most powerful decision makers. Amazingly, Joe Biden doesn't seem to have any issues with his son's choice of business partners or the inescapable negative optics of potential bribery, of purchasing access, of elite privilege, not to mention the misuse of Air Force Two created by such deals. But then Biden has been a China cheerleader for decades, actively pushing to pass permanent national trade relations with China in 2001. Recent comments Biden has made on the campaign trail reveal that he remains utterly clueless about China's strategic long game against the West. "China is going to eat our lunch? Come on, man," he said. "They can't even figure out how to deal with the fact that they have this great division between the China Sea and the mountains in the West. They can't figure out how they're going to deal with the corruption that exists within the system. They're not bad folks, folks, but guess what? They're not competition for us." When a nation gives your son and his partners $1 billion to invest, I guess it's hard to think of them as competition. But tricking America into this kind of short-term thinking is all a part of China's ultimate strategy. This is how dangerously entrenched and intertwined China has become with America's political elite. But China has equally hypnotized the so-called wizards of Wall Street. The heads of major investment houses have become some of China's most vocal cheerleaders. Blackstone Group CEOs Stephen Schwarzman and Ray Dalio, co-chairman of the massive Bridgewater hedge fund, have consistently portrayed China as an unquestionably positive economic force. Their bullish attitude is understandable as far as their own profit motives are concerned. The fees generated on trillions of dollars of trades and bonds are astounding. The research division of the Federal Bank of St. Louis put the total 2017 revenue of all securities brokerages at $147,917,000,000. So promoting the trade of Chinese stocks and bonds adds to brokerage earnings. China also often serves as both a Wall Street backer and a client. Dow Jones reports that Chinese firms, including the China Investment Corporation and the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, both government agencies, have invested billions in Bridgewater's existing hedge funds. The tech world has also been targeted by CCP tactics. Ray Bingham, formerly a board member of tech giant Oracle and executive chairman of U.S. chipmaker Cypress Semiconductor Corporation, was hired in 2016 by Canyon Bridge, a private equity company funded by China Reform Fund Management, a Chinese state-owned investment firm. According to a letter to Cypress stockholders, Bingham received a $1.2 million signing bonus from Canyon Bridge, $2 million in salary, plus his carried interest of 20% of Canyon Bridge's profits. Carried interest is a term specifying that a partner will get a commission regardless of whether he contributed to a deal in any way. By hiring someone with Bingham's savvy and understanding of technology, China found yet another point man to guide strategic acquisitions and funnel key technology to China. And, as expected, Bingham's first move was to try to purchase his former company, a deal that was stopped because of national security concerns. These are just a few high-profile examples of how China connects with America's elite, the people who make policy and monetary decisions for our nation and around the globe. They have fostered engagement with China, and those decisions have had a direct, brutal impact on American citizens. Simply put, 3.4 million U.S. jobs vanished between 2001 and 2017 due to our trade relationship with China, according to The China Toll Deepens, a 2018 study by the Economic Policy Institute, EPI. China joined the World Trade Organization, WTO, in 2001. Since that time, according to the EPI, America's growing trade deficit has swelled, and the impact of that imbalance has been cataclysmic. The study found that nearly 75% of the jobs lost between 2001 and 2017, 2.5 million, calculated by subtracting the number of job opportunities lost to imports from the number of jobs created by exports, were in manufacturing. That's a staggering number of Americans, roughly the equivalent of the population of Houston, who have been put out of work. When Americans think of bad times, they think of the Great Depression, but according to the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, in the 2000s, the decline in manufacturing jobs, 5.7 million, as a share of total manufacturing jobs, 33%, exceeded the rate of loss in the Great Depression, 30.9%. The EPI study is filled with other disturbing numbers, including a finding that trade deficits with China between 2001 and 2011 reduced the incomes of directly impacted U.S. workers by $37 billion per year. The report also contains many concise insights about China's trade-distorting practices, such as extending large subsidies to industries such as steel, glass, paper, concrete, and renewable energy industries, and rapidly growing its state-owned enterprises, both of which generated a massive buildup of excess capacity in a range of these sectors. This excess capacity created a supply of goods far exceeding Chinese consumer demand, and China dealt with the oversupply by dumping the exports elsewhere, primarily in the United States. The political leaders and financial elite I've mentioned here all share one thing in common. They have been operating under a false assumption that our interactions with China are just part of a normal free market competition. They have failed to realize that the Chinese Communist Party has not played by the rules of international law. Instead, it has been conducting a war, one that we have been losing steadily for decades. As a result, our citizens, our cities, and our nation have been gravely wounded. The risks to our nation are increasing rather than decreasing. Every minute we turn a blind eye to China's theft of billions of dollars worth of intellectual property and technology, to years of piracy and copyright law violations, to the CCP's closed economy, the artificial valuation of its own currency, its relentless political influencing operations, and so much more. As we continue to turn a blind eye, our nation moves closer to losing its independence and its freedom. They fail, in other words, to realize that we are losing the stealth war. Unrestricted warfare. The Chinese Communist Party's ultimate goal, which even the most powerful and well-connected are clueless of or complicit in, is to strengthen itself at every turn. The CCP believes that its biggest obstacle, and indeed its greatest threat, is the United States of America, inasmuch as it remains the global economic and military leader. The party's goal and biggest challenge is to displace America's position on the world stage. The CCP's own documents state as much. Perhaps the most important and revealing of these documents is a 1999 work called Unrestricted Warfare. Written by two senior colonels in China's People's Liberation Army, PLA, Zhao Liang and Wang Xiangshui, it outlined a number of strategies to tilt the balance of power throughout the globe in China's favor. It should be required reading for all branches of the U.S. government and for business leaders because it outlines, in no uncertain terms, the strategy behind China's policies in the world. Here is a short, chilling passage. The new principles of war are no longer using armed force to compel the enemy to submit to one's will, but rather are using all means, including armed force or non-armed force, military and non-military, and lethal and non-lethal means to compel the enemy to accept one's interests. Unrestricted warfare is not fun, light reading. It is dense, complex reading material that combines strategy and economics, social theory, and trenchant observations on technology. It is, however, brilliant, and arguably the most important philosophical and strategic book about warfare of our generation. It was first published in China and widely read within the CCP. Among modern-day China scholars, it is well known, but perhaps because of its strange complexity, the West has failed to connect its strategic musings with China's often misleadingly benign and smiling diplomacy. What the CCP realizes, and what unrestricted warfare lays out, is that a nation no longer needs a vast army in order to conquer, to control another country's population, its resources, or its government. Military might is only one way to express aggression, only one of many ways to attain power. In China's view, economic power strengthens all the fields of potential engagement. In other words, money bolsters the military, but it also bolsters every other sphere of engagement imaginable. It can be used to influence and sway political leaders in foreign countries, silence ideas, and purchase or steal technology. It can be used to manufacture goods at dirt-cheap prices and drive competitors out of business or weaken rival economies. It can be used to create an army of academics who fan out to gather scientific, technological, and engineering intelligence that can be used to further other goals. It becomes clear, viewed from the calculating perspective of unrestricted warfare, that our leaders failed to understand that CCP leaders are merely paying lip service to free trade and globalization while blatantly ignoring the laws governing free trade. China welcomes investment, but it won't let investors take their profits out of the country. Chinese companies set up shop all around the world, but the totalitarian CCP puts all kinds of limits on foreign companies growing in China. Since the end of the Cold War, leaders in the West have operated under an economic theory that free markets lead to greater wealth. This concept has merged with something called the theory of modernization, a sociological idea asserting that democracy is the direct result of economic growth. As Seymour Lipset, one of the proponents of this theory, put it, the more well-to-do a nation, the greater the chances that it will sustain democracy. In other words, free trade leads to wealth, and wealth leads to democracy. This is the idea behind Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, and it was the theory that led America's elites to partner with the Chinese Communist Party. See, America's elites understood the power of the world order created by Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt in a document that still serves as the template for that order as we know it. The Atlantic Charter, all of one page, lays out the principles that would govern international behavior for the next 70-plus years and underpin other well-known institutions like the United Nations and the WTO. While the Charter has 8 paragraphs, there are essentially 4 principles that govern the international system. 1. Free markets. 2. Democratic principles. 3. Rule of law. And 4. Self-determination. It was these 4 principles that America's elites believed would lead to China's eventual democratization. Unfortunately, Lipset and so many others in the West failed to understand the intractable nature of the totalitarian Chinese Communist Party, which regards democracy as a fundamental threat to its existence and figured out a way to game the free market system. The CCP believed that it could turn the tables on the West by convincing Western leaders that it agreed with the principles of the world order, while systematically working to undermine them all. In 2017, when Chinese President Xi Jinping went to the annual World Economic Forum, the epicenter of globalization, in Davos, Switzerland, he said, "We must remain committed to developing global free trade and investment, promote trade and investment liberalization and facilitation through opening up, and say no to protectionism." It sounds like he is adopting the West's point of view, but here is where the CCP turns the tables and why its influence is so subtle, cunning, and effective. Let me explain. In aerial combat, pilots talk about creating a shared mental model with the other aircraft crew members. This allows for perfect choreography when communication is not possible in a combat environment. In order to achieve a shared mental model, it is not sufficient to just understand the words. Our intent, what we want to achieve and how we are going to react to make our plans a reality, must be crystal clear. In Davos, the audience heard the words coming out of Xi's mouth, but they did not hear or understand Xi's ultimate intent. They believed that Xi's words meant that He agreed to the underlying principles of globalization, and that is what he wanted them to hear. But when one parses what he actually said and what was left unsaid, it becomes clear she offered no firm commitment to anything. There is no mention of adhering to international law, no mention of changing monetary policy to allow for the free flow of earnings out of China. To whom is she saying no to protectionism? Not China. Everything about economic policy in China is protectionist. He's saying the West should not be protectionist because that serves CCP goals. So, in fact, the leader of China was subtly undermining the laws of free trade and globalization while appearing to agree with them. She and the CCP have crafted a shrewd strategy, and they have had the perfect unwitting allies in this scheme. America's elites. By now you've probably guessed what happens in aerial combat when the team doesn't share the correct mental model. Chaos. The same can be said for the world order that exists today, and that's the reason for this book. What she was actually saying at Davos was that he needed the West to stay open for business. While he was professing agreement with prevailing Western economic and social theory, he was actually operating on CCP theory. Instead of free trade leading to wealth and wealth leading to democracy, his mental model said globalization and the Internet enable the CCP to gain power at the West's expense by accessing Western money to fund China's economic, military, and technological growth, and thereby increasing his nation's power and influence across the globe. By hijacking the mental model of America's elites, by selling them a fraudulent dream of free trade on a level playing field, she could essentially co-opt them, luring them into a game of subterfuge. More important, since the CCP controls China's purse strings, he could set the incentives so that his allies got rich supporting China's power grab. It is, in essence, the perfect strategy. Promise your enemy short-term profits and enlist them to help make your country the most powerful in the world. America's elites have been jumping at the chance to join the bandwagon for over 40 years, as if it were a dream come true. Get rich while making the world safe for democracy. Fortunately, one thing was standing in the way. The U.S. Constitution, which guarantees our citizens' freedoms, including the right to vote. A concept the totalitarian CCP can never imagine. The 3.4 million Americans unemployed by China's great game, along with many of their families and friends, decided they had had enough. Economic and social theory be damned, they were going to make their voices heard. And some of our leaders heard them. We saw this begin to play out in the 2016 national election, as candidates from both sides of the political spectrum, Democrat Bernie Sanders and Republican Donald Trump, began speaking to those who have been abandoned and victimized by unfair free trade, the China shock to our economy. We also saw this in the 2018 midterm elections as politicians adopted platforms that called for providing more support, higher minimum wages, improved health care for those abandoned as their jobs were taken overseas. This book is for and about the men and women of America who yearn for the better life they had before their elites welcomed their enemy into the WTO and into their lives. The following chapters tell the story about where their country has gone wrong and how to get it back on track. And yes, that story is about China's stealth war, the manipulation and duping of America's elites, while hugely important, is only one aspect of a multi-pronged, relentless offensive. But it is also about America winning that war, about forming a more perfect union, establishing justice, and ensuring domestic tranquility, about providing for the common defense and promoting the general welfare. Mostly, though, it's about preventing a dystopian future and securing the blessings of liberty for ourselves and for generations to come. The fact is, we have about 3 years to stop the CCP's unrestricted war. If we don't, the ideals of liberty that have shaped America, our defining concepts of freedom and independence, will face almost certain destruction at the hands of a totalitarian government that values nothing more than its own power. That power is targeting our country in ways that affect everyone, at every level. When China succeeds in luring U.S. investment dollars, those are dollars that are not being invested domestically. That is capital that is leaving America, that could have been invested in America, that could have been used to generate jobs here. When a Chinese company pirates an electronic device developed in the United States by an American company and then sells that knockoff device, it is stealing income from the company that invested in creating the device. That loss of income has further repercussions, which can translate into loss of jobs, loss of tax revenue, and loss of future earnings. The CCP's actions and inactions don't just hurt a corporation or a manufacturer. They are attacks on our society as a whole. The average American citizen needs to understand this. Chapter 2. How We Got Here. The magnitude and complexity of the stealth war that the Chinese Communist Party initiated against the United States and the rest of the Western world is so great that even a close observer of today's headlines will have difficulty grasping it. China's stealth war reaches back not months or years into the past, but centuries. They've been refining their view of history, strategic culture, and political philosophy for much longer than the United States or even the West as we know it today have been around. If we continue to ignore our differences with China that are at the root of the stealth war, we'll continue to lose. In Western democracies, we have rule of law. Leaders are elected by the people to make laws. Government institutions codify, implement, and enforce the laws. The law is the highest power in the land. There are, ideally, checks and balances and oversight to ensure that the laws are followed. In China, there is rule by law. Unlike the United States, where all citizens have due process, which guarantees they have legal rights that must be honored by the state, and where we have carefully defined laws to establish, administer, and change legislation, the CCP makes the laws, and the people of China have no say in the matter. The law rules them. There is no recourse. The CCP defines the law, and citizens have no way to challenge the law. Nothing, therefore, is more powerful than the Chinese Communist Party. What drives the CCP? What is the model it relies on to sustain this authoritarian party? And how can a nation even conceive of such a long-term plan and then steer that course? The answer lies in China's history, its strategic culture, and its view of power and competition. China's strategic culture is intertwined with Confucian ideas of hierarchy, harmony, and responsibility, and mixed with pragmatic views on how power, wealth, and influence can be attained. Time is a living element with ebbs and flows, outcomes that maximize the benefit for the majority and ignore the wishes of the minority are pursued. Use of military force is viewed not as a means to an end, but as a necessity. Economic relationships, financial competition, and the use of information help create influence, and influence is the next best thing to actual power. China has a 5,000-year history of empire building. Dynasties rose, dynasties fell. Many were complex, far-reaching, all-powerful societies that are among the biggest empires the world has ever seen. In roughly 770 BC, the golden era of China ended, giving way to the years known as the Spring and Autumn period. followed by the Warring States period. Various leaders and armies engaged in complex subterfuge, tenuous alliances, secret missions, and cold-blooded betrayals. All in the name of consolidating power and control, like Game of Thrones, but real. During the spring and autumn period, philosopher Confucius had a huge impact on Chinese culture. A teacher, judge, and minister of justice, he believed in the transformative power of education and the obligation of teachers and students to improve society. The political events of the Warring States period helped shape what has become China's best-known book in the West, The Art of War, by a military strategist named Sun Tzu. Countless generations of military officers all over the world have studied this book, but so have diplomats, philosophers, and businessmen. This wide appeal is a testament to the genius of Sun Tzu's work. For a book on warfare, it spends a lot of time discussing how to advance national interests, or any interest really, without actually going to war. Sun Tzu implies that the Chinese society values rigorous, cutthroat competition as a means of advancing goals without creating the risk of actual combat. Given these foundational texts, is it any surprise that more than 2,000 years after Sun Tzu put his ideas to paper, this strategy of war without actual combat to further national goals is in full effect? The battle begins. After Mao Zedong rose to power in 1949, ending a grueling civil war and launching the People's Republic of China and the CCP, a plan began to take root for the nation to embark on a 100-year marathon. As amorphous as it was ambitious, the undetailed plan was to return China to its proper place in the world as a great empire. Providing added motivation to Mao and his impoverished nation was a desire for vengeance against the current world order. Mao viewed the lowlights inflicted upon China over the previous 100 years, the British Navy destroying its ports to win the Opium Wars, the collapse of the Qing Dynasty in 1912, and Japan's seizures of Korea and Manchuria as a century of humiliation. The CCP continues to foster resentment over these national humiliations by treating them as unhealed wounds and indoctrinating students about them in all grade levels, from kindergarten through university. The start of the marathon was not easy. There was painfully slow growth. China aligned itself with its totalitarian cousin, the Soviet Union, which itself had limited resources and productivity. In 1958, Mao initiated the Great Leap Forward, a plan to industrialize China and reshape agrarian practices. The program backfired when drought, lack of productivity, and faulty planning led to the 4-year-long Great Famine, which left tens of millions dead. In 1966, Mao used the CCP to launch the so-called Cultural Revolution, a brutal purge designed to rid the population of traditional Chinese and capitalist ways. Teachers, businessmen, intelligentsia, religious leaders, and civil servants were jailed and sent to re-education camps. Citizens were denounced and publicly humiliated. Property was seized. Populations were forcibly relocated. Torture, executions, and even mass murder were common. Millions perished. The terror of the Cultural Revolution, a communist totalitarian government run amok, is hard for Americans to fathom. The upheaval touched virtually everyone. Chinese dissident and journalist Sasha Gong has a haunting memory of the time. She was a little girl living with her family in a 40-unit Guangzhou apartment building when her parents and their neighbors were taken away. At one point, she recalls, there was only one adult in the entire building living among the abandoned children and teens. During the 1950s and 1960s, China was, to an extent, a silent partner in the Cold War, presenting itself as harmless and backward compared with a superpower like the Soviet Union. While it backed communist forces in the Korean and Vietnam Wars, China limited overt expansionist and imperialist dreams to its immediate neighbors. In comparison, the Soviet Union was far more expansionist, deploying troops and military support to various African nations, including Angola, Ethiopia, and Somalia, bolstering Castro's Cuba and, in fact, providing aid and education to China. Mao and the CCP's relationship with the USSR was what boxing champion Muhammad Ali might have called an international rope-a-dope. By playing Moscow's poor, distant communist cousin,